I'll read a little excerpt from this new book, Glimpses of Eternity. There is something about being in the presence of death, not necessarily our own, that can open a portal to a higher world, one that those who are dying can open to those who will go on living. It's part of the concept that Dr. Raymond Moody has explored in this new book called A Shared Death Experience. Now, when I say he's a pioneer in this area of research, I'm not kidding. He's the guy who coined the phrase near-death experience. His book, Life After Life, sold something like 13 million copies around the world. It's been read by millions of additional people. It has basically changed the way we look at death. And I think in a positive, very positive way, it's even affected how dying patients are treated around the country and around the world. Dr. Moody is my guest, and we jump right into it right after this break on Coast to Coast AM. I actually had a chance to meet and interview Dr. Raymond Moody, interview for television some years ago when he lived here in Las Vegas. He was chairman, I think, of the consciousness, human consciousness department, a department or a program that existed at UNLV for a period. Yeah, at least he held the chair there, and got to meet him and talk to him, and I was hooked. I was hooked a long time ago, though, on this subject of life after life. As I mentioned, that book has sold millions of copies. Dr. Moody, great to have you here. Great to talk to you again.
Oh, George, it's just great to hear from you too, man. I often think back of our as to our years there in Las Vegas, and I really enjoyed our time together. We crossed paths on numerous occasions during that time.
Tell me this, am I overselling the impact of life after life, how it has changed the way the world looks at
You
death
know,
and
George, to my utter astonishment, I don't think you are. I mean, I was just amazed. I had encountered this phenomenon of the near-death experience when I was an undergraduate philosophy student at the University of Virginia in 1962, when I read about this in Plato's Republic, and some of the other ancient Greek philosophers studied these near-death experiences. And then while I was there at UVA as a philosophy student, I met Dr. George Ritchie, who was a psychiatry professor there who had had such an experience. And I was intrigued immediately by this. It was just, to me, amazing. And Dr. Ritchie, a very fine and upright, wonderful man. And since that time, I've had the opportunity to interview many thousands of people from all around the world who've had this experience. But, you know, when I was writing that book in 1974, based on, at that time, about 150 cases, I really had no idea that it would have the impact that it has, but I think that, as you say, this has sort of changed society's image of what it's like to die, and it's gone all around the world. Now, at the same time, it doesn't have anything to do with Raymond Moody. What it had to do with was, I think, the fact that by the 1960s and 70s, the availability of this cardiopulmonary resuscitation had created a pool of such vast numbers of people who had this experience that eventually someone was just going to draw attention to it. And when that happened, which happened to be my book, then it sort of contains its own verification in the sense that I got quite a few comments after Life After Life was published that took the same form, that, you know, they said they were reading my book on an airport or in an airplane or in a train or something, and just curious about it, and the person sitting there next to them looked at it and said, "Oh, I had an experience like this." So anybody at that point who just had the courage to sort of step forward and put this out there was bound to get plenty of cases of it. It was just, and I think the message of these experiences is a very positive. positive and hopeful thing, because what people universally tell us who come back from this is that they were absolutely assured by their experience that what we call death is just a transition into another dimension of reality, and secondly, that what this seems to be all about that we're in is to learn how to love. And both of those are very positive messages, I think.
Well, I mean, it's certainly, there's a reason. It's in your book is excellent. It was well written, as this one is. But, you know, there's a universal message here. It touches a nerve with all humans because it focuses on the biggest questions of our existence. What happens after we die? Are we immortal? Do we have a soul? Does life go on after this little experience? And as you mentioned, the answer from the cases that you studied and written about is pretty positive. You mentioned George Ritchie, and you mentioned him in this book, Glimpses of Eternity, as well. Could you just recap that case so we cover the basics of the near-death experience?
George Ritchie was a professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia, and when George was a recruit into the Army during World War II in 1943, he, at the age of 20, he was pronounced dead of double lobar pneumonia and was in this state of apparent cardiac arrest at least 9 minutes. They don't even know how long he had already been apparently dead when the ward boy found his body. And the Dr. Francie, the physician at this Army hospital, after being, you know, the pleading of this ward boy who just couldn't stand to see a person of his own age, so young, die, persuaded Dr. Francie to inject adrenaline into George's heart. And when he did, George came back with this story that when he had come to, he looked and he saw his own body lying there on this hospital bed, and unable to get back into his body and never having heard anything like this, just utterly baffled. Whereupon suddenly he said, the light in the room just grew intensely brilliant, and he suddenly found himself surrounded by a full-color, holographic, three-dimensional panorama consisting of every single event, every single action he had ever done in his life, and got to review his life in the presence of this being of complete love and compassion. And during this time, George also saw into entirely other realms of existence. And I heard this story directly from George Ritchie himself in 1965. I was 20 years old at that time. And especially after hearing it in the context of already the admiration I felt toward Plato and the ancient Greek philosophers, this just cinched it for me. And then when I became a philosophy professor in 1969, I began to hear these same stories from my students. Then I went on to medical school in 72, and I began to hear a lot of them from patients that I worked with. And, you know, what we found, George, is, you know, all over the world, I mean, physicians in every society have examined this and found this same pattern of experience worldwide, in which people say that at this point that their doctor thinks that they're dead, often in the course of a cardiac arrest or whatever, that they may actually hear the doctor say words to the effect, oh, my God, he's dead, or we've lost her, or words like that. But they say at this point they undergo a very dramatic transition, excuse me, a perspective on this situation, and suddenly find themselves viewing their own physical bodies from a point of view up above. And then through this, as it gradually dawns on them that this is what we call death. They find themselves entering into a state of consciousness that no matter how articulate they may be, however well educated, however many languages they may speak, they say there just are no words to describe it. But insofar as they are able to put words to it, they say that they enter into another domain of existence which consists of sheer light, and that seems to be composed almost of complete love and comfort and compassion. And in that light, say that relatives or friends of theirs who have already died seem to be there almost in the role of a greeting committee. And that, again, as I mentioned, as the experience progresses, they may see everything they've ever done in this panorama. And they relive the panorama or the events of their lives in this panorama, not from the perspective they had when they were doing the actions, but rather they say that in this panorama, you see yourself there as though you're looking at another person, and you recognize it as yourself, but that when the action that you did has its consequence, that you are embedded in the consciousness of those with whom you've interacted. So if you see yourself doing something mean to somebody there, then you feel directly the hurt that you caused in that person's life. Or if you see yourself doing something kind-hearted to a fellow human, then you feel the good feelings you brought about in that person's life. And so, you know, George, I think that we are into a whole new domain of studying this experience, because the way we sort of learned to debate it in our society, the standard format that you're supposed to put this debate into is to say, on the one hand, the people who look at this and they say, well, on the face of it, this seems that, you know, that these people are entering some sort of afterlife realm, or that this is a report from the afterlife. And then on the other hand, there are people who look at it and say, oh, well, sure, you know, they were physiologically compromised, being in this state of cardiac arrest, the oxygen flow to the brain was cut off, and so on. And so no wonder that they would have this, because this is all a hallucinatory phenomenon generated by the brain because of the electrochemical reactions taking place in the brain, and so on. And our society... this makes a certain sort of superficially plausible case, you know, so it can, people can go back and forth with it. But now you see, just as certainly as we know that this near-death experience is very common among people who almost die in return, with that same certainty we can say, well, also, that identically same experience is also very common among bystanders when somebody dies.
Let's don't jump ahead of ourselves. Yeah. I want to get a little more of the backstory before we get into the shared experience. Sure, sure. You mentioned in the book, of course, the George Ritchie case. Mm-hmm. Isn't there something like where he flew across the country and then and was able to retrace his route years later?
He did. And before I say this, I should say, you know, I'm 67 years old now, George, and I've known a lot of people in my life. I can honestly say that George Ritchie was the finest human being I ever knew. He was just, living in Charlottesville, and I was a physician there myself. And you get to know about somebody like that through things he's done for others and so on. Just an absolutely unflappably terrific man of just immovable integrity and kindness. And yes, he talked about how there at age 20 years old, quite brilliant. He had already graduated from college, but nonetheless, certainly not suspecting that he was going to die anytime soon and never having thought about this kind of thing, suddenly finds himself out of his body. And he realized nobody could see him. Nobody could hear him. He tried to talk to people. Nobody would pay any attention to him. So this was in Camp Barkley, Texas. So he got the idea, well, maybe if I go home to Richmond, somebody there maybe, I can get their attention. So he just like suddenly having formulated that thought, he said, that he wanted to go home to Richmond, he suddenly found himself just zooming through the air, kind of like at above treetop level. And then sometime through this, got to thinking, well, just a minute. If nobody there in Texas can see me, I don't have any reason to believe that the people there in Richmond can see me either. And besides, my body is back there in Texas. So he decided just to sort of settle down in this little town, like that he was down below, and to try to figure this out. And he said he landed in this little town. He had no idea where he was, and he was at a place where there was a little white diner on a corner on this street. And he said he saw a man walking by, and he tried to ask this man, where am I? And he said the man totally ignored him. So he said he tried to touch this man on the cheek, and he just went right through. And so very, very puzzled. And so then trying to, figure this out again, he went back to his body there in this Army hospital in Texas. Well, about a year later, when he was still in the Army, but he was, at that time, he was having to go back across the country again. And he said he was driving through this little town, and somebody else was driving the car, this other Army officer. But George said they were driving through this little town, and he said, George realized it was very familiar, and he also knew he had never been there in real life. And so he realized he was in that little town, and he said he told the driver, if you go down this street about another block, there'll be a little white diner on the corner. And the man said, I thought you'd never been here. He said, I haven't, but go on down there. And so there was the diner. And, I coming from George Ritchie, that's amazing. And then,
but I raised that question because there are a lot of examples in your work, in the story of people learning things while they're in that other state that turn out to be confirmable over when they're back here.
That's right. That's right. And this is, I've just heard some of the most amazing experiences along those lines from utterly trustworthy people, including this wonderful friend of mine, Vi Horton, that I knew for 20-something years before she died a few years ago. But Vi, during her 20-minute cardiac arrest, where the doctor and nurse couldn't hear her or see her, migrated out of the hospital room where she was being resuscitated and saw one of her brothers-in-law there in the hallway of the hospital. And, of course, the brother-in-law couldn't see or hear her, but she said as she was standing there, or as he was standing there, and she was kind of hovering, watching, a man sort of walked down the hospital corridor and, seeing her brother-in-law there, said, oh, what are you doing in the hospital? And
Dr. Moody, I'm going to have to ask you to hold the punchline. That Fats Domino song is telling us we're going to the break. When we come back, we continue this conversation. Also get into Ernest Hemingway and Charles Dickens' touches with the near-death experience. writing about it, and at least in some vein. Our conversation with Dr. Raymond Moody, author of Glimpses of Eternity, continues after these messages on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Raymond Moody is my guest. His new book, Glimpses of Eternity, talks about a shared near-death experience. He references in the book a couple of what appear to be references to near-death and out-of-body experiences from literature. Ernest Hemingway, and For Whom the Bell Tolls, has what sounds like an out-of-body experience. In a way, you could say that Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol sounds a heck of a lot like an uncomfortable life review for Scrooge, which is similar to what has been described in Dr. Moody's books. When we come back, we jump into the discussion of the shared experience and how it happens and involves people who are not necessarily dying. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Moody, let's continue the story about your friend Vi, who had a 20-minute sort of out-of-body experience, near-death experience, and floated around into the hallway, I guess, at the hospital. Continue the story.
Yes, and saw there her brother-in-law, who was standing there in the hospital corridor. And of course, he couldn't see or hear her, but as she was watching him, a friend of his happened to be in the hospital and walked by and was surprised to see him there and said, "Oh, you know, why are you here at the hospital?" And Vi's brother-in-law said, "Well, I was going to go to Athens today to visit Uncle Henry, but it looks like Vi's going to kick the bucket, so I'm going to have to be around to be a pallbearer." So Vi took note of that, and then several days later, after she had been resuscitated and regained consciousness, her brother-in-law came to see her, and when he walked into the hospital room, she said, "By the way," she said, "the next time I die, I want you to go on to Athens to see Uncle Henry, because I'm going to be fine." And incidentally, I talked in detail about this event with her brother-in-law, who was a very, very sort of strict businessman type. And this event just absolutely, totally changed his life, absolutely.
As it has for so many people, on both sides of the equation. I think the most persuasive part of the new book, Glimpses of Eternity, is the fact that, you know, the critics who say this can't be true, it's a neurological response, it's people who, you know, their brains are firing all this stuff off, they're dreaming it, whatever the explanation, because there's only one witness, you know. So people say, "I went over there, I came back, you have to believe me, it was all true." But in this case, the shared experience, you've got multiple witnesses, independent witnesses, independent confirmation from several people in many of these cases that it all really happened.
Absolutely. And also, since the bystanders are not ill or injured, there's nothing wrong with the blood flow to their brain. And yet they have identically the same experiences that we call near-death experiences, including George. The Panoramic Life Review, I have quite a number of cases in which the bystander empathically co-lived the dying life review of the person who passed away. And, I mean, there are enough of these cases that anybody who wants to sincerely investigate this is going to be able to find cases of it. And what does that mean? I mean, you know, we're into a realm here where these kind of pat explanations by the so-called skeptics, and not to be abrasive, George, but, you know, I was a professor of ancient Greek philosophy and logic before I went to medical school, and you know, I mean, it's the people who call themselves skeptics aren't skeptics at all. The way they talk makes it clear that they, you know, haven't even studied the concept enough to know what it means, but basically, you know, this idea that we can dismiss this as brain damage or electrochemical disturbance in the brain, It typically comes from people who haven't really talked to patients. By and large, they are armchair investigators who just hear about this from reading about it in books or something, and then they come up with these hypotheses. But this is just not going to fly anymore. I mean, all of the things that we identify as a near-death experience are commonly reported by people who are standing there at the bedside. Now, when I first started hearing this, the first one I heard was from one of my own medical school professors in 1972.
Dr. Jameson.
Yes, although that's a pseudonym.
Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, this is a very wonderful medical professor I had at the when I went to medical school, and so she had the misfortune of, you know, seeing her mother have a cardiac arrest right in front of her, and had to be the one there trying to resuscitate her mother, and her mother did pass away. But she said that as her mother passed away, she herself, this physician, left her own body, rose up, and to use her exact words, she said, "I was trying to get my bearings and looked around and saw her mother," again to use her exact words, "now in spirit form there beside her." And she said she could actually look down. She could see her own physical body beside the bed of her mother. She could see her mother's physical body, now deceased, in the bed. And then in this other perspective, she could see that her mother, in this spirit form, now there beside her. She said her goodbyes to her mother, and she said she saw her mother recede into this light and being met by these people, some of whom she recognized as people who had been friends and relatives of her mother's who had passed away. And so back in at that period of time, in on through the 70s and the late 70s, I heard these almost exclusively from medical people, doctors and nurses. And what you hear actually quite often from doctors, I mean, this is not the kind of thing that they're going to tell you about openly unless, you know, they know that you're sympathetic. But doctors will tell you that as the patient dies, sometimes they seem to see something that is very described in one of two ways, but which seem pretty equivalent, really, is that some people describe it as a sort of transparent image or replica of the dying person who stands up and moves away from the body. Or sometimes this is described as a sort of globular, light, grayish and or goldenish, which rises up and leaves the body. And so I began to hear these, like I said, in the 70s and through the early 80s. And then it seems like probably about the mid-80s, there was a shift in it, and I began to hear many more of them from bystanders at the bedside who were like relatives. And concurrently with that, what you were seeing in medical practice is that when I entered medicine in 1972, the standard way of handling the death situation would be that when we saw that the patient was, you know, in the terminal phase, the doctors and nurses would come in, and it was a kind of paternalistic attitude. But now, what we thought was, oh, you know, it's too overwhelming for the patient's family. So, you know, we'll be the heroes. And so the family would usually sort of be escorted out. But then, in a period of time, this began to shift. Whereas now, in 2011, is more the standard practice that the doctors and nurses, unless they have a close personal bond with the patient, will tend to make themselves scarce and encourage the family to be there with the dying person at the very end.
Which is profoundly better, both for the dying person and for the family.
Yeah. Yes, excuse me, this I should explain to the you and to the listeners that just in the past couple of days, the goldenrod has bloomed around here.
Oh.
So that's the cough. I'm terribly allergic to it. But it's a much better system. And so with that, I'm still hearing this from doctors, but much more now from the patient's families. And back in about, it was, to be precise, it was in May of 1994, George. I was out there in Las Vegas, and this was before I went to teach there, but we were planning to put together a systematic study of these shared death experiences. And it was on Mother's Day, 1994. So after our planning meeting broke up, I called my mom from the shopping mall out there to wish her a happy Mother's Day. And I found out that the day before that she had developed a rash, which they didn't think was serious. But the next day, to make a long story short, she went to the doctor for a more thorough examination. And it turned out to be non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and she was told she had 2 days to 2 weeks to live. Well, my wife and I went there, and we were with my mom at her bedside the whole time, that 2 weeks as it was, until she passed away. But when she did, my wife and I and my brother-in-law and my sister had this shared death experience. And I'm driven in what I do by curiosity, and that kind of diffused my curiosity. In other words, you can't be you're still curious about it when it's happened to you, but I mean, it was such a shock in a way. And so I spent a long time integrating that, and then I kept on collecting cases of it. So now, as you said, I put it in this book, Glimpses of Eternity. And I want to give credit, by the way, to my dear friend and co-writer, Paul Perry, who wrote this with me, because Paul and I have been working together and been good friends since 1988. And Paul has written many books on near-death experiences with Melvin Morse as well, who's the pediatrician who's done this. But we've put this together, yeah, and I think... this is bound to change the whole tenor of the debate, because we can't get away anymore with trying to run away from this by saying, oh, this is just brain damage, or the person there is during the resuscitation, the oxygen flow is cut off, because that just totally fails to explain why the bystanders have the same experience.
Well, let's jump back to your experience. Now, you and your wife and your in-laws went where? What happened?
Well, George, my experience actually tends to be fairly typical of a lot of this that I've heard from other people, too. And this is just as I've heard from so many people over the years, and you have, too. It's like people say, there are no words. I mean, the words sound crazy, but this is what I experienced as my mother was in the process of dying. George, I don't know how to explain it except that the room changed configuration. We were no longer in a three-dimensional space. The best way I can describe this is the configuration of the room, instead of like being a three-dimensional box or cubicle like a hospital room is. It was kind of like you were in the apex of a funnel or a double funnel, kind of like an hourglass. Like the room seemed to sort of pinch up in the middle is the only way I know. It's like we were in a sort of like a funnel of light. That just sounds so bizarre. But the structure of the room changed, or the geometry of it changed, and the tenor of the light. People say light, But that's a misnomer. I mean, the reason you have to say light is that that's the only word that's even vaguely like it. You could also say love, and it wouldn't be any different. I mean, it's love or light or this sheer love energy or light energy just permeates everything. And, you know, people who might tend to think that this is some kind of dreamlike thing, it's this is more real than ordinary waking consciousness. This is not like a dream. You know, when people wake up in the morning from a dream, they feel like they're coming back to reality, right? Because when you wake up in the morning and you've had in some sort of odd dream, and you're trying to hold on to those bizarre images, but then it kind of fades because you think, what is that? You have this feeling that you're coming back to reality. Well, in the kind of experience I'm talking about, you have that same feeling, except this reality is what's the dream, is the weird thing. I mean, that is more real than this ordinary waking consciousness. And for that reason, the language we try to use to describe it just breaks down. And it is just absolutely astonishing. My sister saw the presence of my father there at my mother's death, and my father had died 18 months before. This is another very common thing people say, that they say that as the person in the bed dies, that they see the spirits of the deceased person's loved ones sort of come around or enter the room as a sort of to take them away. Another thing that happens is that the room, or as I mentioned, just full of this vibrant light. And music is another thing I hear all the time. Just like I was talking to this family not long ago, and the one of the family members said to one of the others, "Do you hear that music that I'm hearing?" And people say that this ethereally beautiful music fills up.
It's not harp music, is it?
No, that's very interesting. There was a study done actually by a musicologist some years ago who also happened to be a clinical psychologist, where he interviewed, I think it was 17 people who had heard music in their near-death experiences. And then he developed the scale to try to figure out what kind of music it was. And everybody agreed that it's George Ritchie. And George was not a person who was, you know, conservative in his values. In saying this, he did not mean to put down the Beatles, but George said that there was no way he could describe it. He said he would have to say that as a rough measure, for example, it's more like Beethoven than the Beatles was his. You know, people say this absolutely unearthly music, just beauty that you can't describe.
Symphonic as opposed to a pop song.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And
did you you said now that your sister saw your dead father. So yeah. The four of you who went along with Mom did not all have the same exact experience.
No, you know, it's like the way I put it together, and I base this not just on my own family's case, but on the other cases I've dealt with where more than one person saw it, is that it's kind of just like if you and I went on a tour to Paris.
Hey, Raymond, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but that music tells us we're going to a break, and I got a feeling we're going to want to hear this line from you uninterrupted. So we're going to take a break now, folks. We'll be back with Dr. Raymond Moody, author of the new book, Glimpses of Eternity, to talk about the shared death experience. Stay with us.